I'm Andy Bienstock, host for Jazz and Big Band Music here on WYPR. Federal funding for public radio is under serious threat. An end to that funding would make live streams like this one difficult to keep going. Stand up for public media and help fortify WYPR's future. Tell your member of Congress you support WYPR by visiting protectmypublicmedia.org. Thanks.
Good afternoon and welcome to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Today, we'll listen to a conversation I had last summer on Juneteenth with Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, the author of a provocative book that explores the centuries-long history of black resistance to white supremacy. Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson is an associate professor and chair of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. Her book is called We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Dr. Carter Jackson frames the rich history of resistance through the lens of five forms of opposition: revolution, protection, force, flight, and joy. Civil rights scholarship has often been situated in the space between the markers of the movement as they were framed in the 1950s and 60s, the nonviolence of Dr. King and the by any means necessary approach of Malcolm X. Dr. Jackson argues that this is a false dichotomy that overlooks many other forms of black defiance in the face of oppression. Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson joined me on Zoom from Boston. Dr. Jackson, it's great to talk to you. Thanks for your time and happy holiday.
Hey, happy Juneteenth. Thanks so much for having me.
So you have these wonderful frames for thinking about black resistance to white supremacy. Again, it's revolution, mm-hmm. protection, force, flight, and joy. Mm-hmm. I wonder, in the process of writing the book and deciding how to organize it, did you have others that you eventually discarded? Did you have,
yeah.
were these the only five you ever started with? I just wonder what the editing process was like, you know?
It actually started out with four chapters. I had not included flight. And then I was like, wait, we have to have flight. We have to have flight. Migration is everywhere in the Black experience. But there were also chapters that got left on the chopping block. I wanted to do a chapter on arson. And my husband was like, no, no, we'll not be talking about fires and burn it all down. I was like, but there's a long history from slave rebellions up until this present day, which I think there is. And there's certainly space for that to be written. But I did not include that. And then I love this book by Trisha Hershey. It's called Rest is Resistance. And if I had more space, I would talk about the importance of rest as well and what it means to stop and quit and take a break. But I do want to make it clear, like, these chapters are not exhaustive. They're not meant to encompass the only things that we can do. They're meant to get us to think and expand beyond the common tools that we've just been given, which is violence or nonviolence. We make those the only options. And I tell my students, I don't like binaries. I don't like dichotomies. I don't like this or that. I like thinking about things through an array of different options. And so I hope people will get imaginative and creative and think of other ways to expand and continue the conversation on this book. That's an author's dream.
Yeah, well, I just think it's such an imaginative way of organizing this argument, because you do include, for example, you didn't include rest, which is an interesting one to ponder, mm-hmm. but you did include joy, at the end. And people don't think of joy as an act of resistance.
Oh, it is. Oh, joy is a weapon. I really see joy as a weapon. I put that chapter last because I want it to be sort of the last thing that you think about. And I think it's something that everyone can use. Not everyone's going to feel comfortable with revolution or protection per se or force. But joy is something that we all engage in. And it's much more than just sort of the superficialness of happiness. It's not like, oh, this ice cream, or oh, I found a dollar on the ground. It's not like meaningless. Joy is actually tethered to oppression. It's tethered to suffering. It's tethered to really hard things, and it really shows our humanity, the ways that we're able to push through or push past and find levity and laughter and find community and love. Like, I see joy as all encompassing in that way. And so for me, it's actually one of the most potent tools, I think, to combat white supremacy, because in our day-to-day experience, there's so much macro and micro that erode people of color, that joy is what fills us up and builds us back up.
You're right that Black joy is the remedy, justice is the healing, mm-hmm. and that we can have both. That's a really interesting observation there. Expand upon that a little bit, the remedy and the healing.
Yeah. Remedies and cures, I think, are two different things. When I think of a remedy, I think of something that you might take for a cold. Like, there's no necessarily a cure for the cold, but you might, you know, eat chicken soup, or you might take a cough drop or something like that. A remedy is meant to alleviate pain symptoms sort of in the short term, but it's not a cure. It's not something that will keep it from ever happening again. And so when I say that joy is not justice, I want to be really clear that joy to me is the splint. It is the crutch. It is the way that we think about how we maintain our lives in the midst of hardship. But justice really is the cure, because justice is what keeps people from being harmed in the first place. It is not just sort of like a splint, but it is healing. And so in America, I talk about this a lot, and maybe it's because I was writing during the pandemic. I was thinking a lot about sort of like, you know, sickness and illness and what's a cure and what's a remedy and how do we prevent and how do we, you know, sort of counteract, and how Black people have been so creative with creating remedies to harms and to violence, that I wanted to think of it along those terms to help people make sense of sort of the gravity of white supremacy in America.
If you've just joined us on this Juneteenth holiday, I'm Tom Hall. My guest is Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson. She's on the faculty of Wellesley College. Her new book is called We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we're not able to take any calls or online comments today. So you argue that trying to solve racism with good ideas or kind words is kind of a feckless enterprise. That belief in, you write from a position of belief in Black humanity, but also with the belief that in the pursuit of freedom, courtesy is not a virtue. Mm. You come right out of the gate. That's in the introduction of the book.
Yeah, that's right.
And yeah, so yeah. Which is what got me very hooked on the book, because I thought, whoa, this is out there in a very contrary way. Courtesy is not a virtue. Mm-hmm. My mama taught me courtesy was a virtue. So what's going on here?
It is, I think, with certain interpersonal connections, you know, manners are always appreciated. But when it comes to solving or combating white supremacy, I think that we have chosen to have these very romantic ideas that we see a lot in Hollywood about how you sort of solve racism by saying please or thank you or holding hands. There's so countless movies in Hollywood of like that sort of narrative that we've seen either in The Help or The Blind Side or The Green Mile, where you have these very interpersonal connections that have nothing to do with like the larger structural systems at play. So by me being kind to my white neighbor doesn't solve racism. Now, it may allow us to have a good relationship, but it doesn't necessarily change the lives for the collective. And so I wanted to kind of push back against those ideas, because I think a lot of the books that came out in 2020 before and thereafter have really pushed ideas about solving racism with like, aren't we all the same, and just have a stiff upper lip and chin up, and, you know, like these platitudes that I feel like ring hollow and empty. And for people who have been really hurt and scarred by racism, please and thank you means nothing. And so even I'm sorry, if it's not backed up with changed behavior, then it doesn't mean anything. You know, even Mr. Rogers said, first you say I'm sorry, then it's how can I help? You know, how can I rectify this harm? How can I make sure I don't repeat this harm? And we don't have a model for what repentance looks like in America, for what it means to sort of relinquish power, to change your ways. We don't have a narrative for that.
And even past the sort of, you know, the courtesy dimension, You're pretty harsh on some people who've been, you know, accepted as you know, really at the forefront of what the new civil rights movement needs to look like. I think of a fellow Bostonian, Ibram X. Kendi, who's been on our show a bunch of times. You know, the anti-racism movement and identifying it, calling it out, understanding it. You don't have a whole lot of tolerance even for that, seems to me.
Well, you know, I think these issues are big and complex. And I say that sort of solving racism is not a DIY. It's not a how-to. I can't give you a three-point plan. I can't give you a formula. If it were that easy, we would have done it a long time ago. And so, while I think the scholarship of like Ibram Kendi and others like him, they have a place, they have a reason for being, but I think that they don't address some of the larger systemic questions that cannot be solved with just sort of slapping anti-racist on it or by simply taking a seminar or a course or a workshop, that it's much more than that. And it's actually something that I think requires more than one tool. So in the book, I say, you know, we need more than one tool. You can't take a hammer and either build or destroy a house with just one hammer. You need more tools than that. And so I also think it's kind of like, I don't know, a disservice to the reader to present them with ideas that can be easily solved when we know that's just not the case. The world is complex and sophisticated and difficult, and that we've been doing this for hundreds of years. And so while I do believe that progress is possible and change is possible and equally important, sustainable, I don't think it's going to be a one fix all, read this book and your problems are all solved kind of thing. So I let the reader know right on, I'm not, if you're looking for solutions, if you're looking for the 3-point plan and the formula and the how to, it's not this book.
Yeah. And you're right. I think there is an impulse for publishers and authors to break it down into, okay, all we need to do is these three things and everything will be fine. And you, this is a book of history. You talk about, you know, everyone from Toussaint Louverture in Haiti to radicals that I'd never heard of personally as a as an old white guy, you know, had just never encountered some of the people you talk about in the 19th century in the United States and the the work that they did and the bravery and courage that they displayed. But you also make a really, what I thought was a really interesting point, again, right at the top of the book, you say that you push against and beyond this dominant civil rights narrative that conditions us to see Black people as worthy actors because of their commitment to nonviolence. I mean, everybody loves Martin Luther King, and it's
so
because he was right, and because he was such a peaceful, loving person, right?
Yeah.
But he was certainly much more complicated than that.
Oh,
but
much
but the whole night, interesting. I was really fascinated with this notion of worthiness of Blackness because of nonviolence.
Yeah. I mean, that is sort of the narrative that I hear a lot, especially when you think about activism today. People are like, why can't you just do it the King way? Be nonviolent. You know, like as though King was not disrupting anything, as though King was not hated during his day. I mean, we forget he was assassinated. This was not a person that was beloved, especially during the height of their, you know, power. He's really calling out America. He's calling out capitalism. He's calling out militarism with the war in Vietnam. I think we have a very skewed version of who MLK was. And I think that we often dilute him or we even, you know, at worst, pervert ideas about him. I think that for those who knew him and loved him, they will tell you, and I love reading this book called This Nonviolent Stuff Will Get You Killed by Charles Cobb. He talks about, you know, if you were at King's house, his house was a fort. He had guns everywhere. There's a story where he's like, whoa, whoa, don't sit in that chair. There's guns underneath that chair. And nonviolence and self-defense are not mutually exclusive. I think we can think of these ideas working in tandem together, that King is not asking us to lie out in the street and have people run us over. That's not what he is arguing. But I think in a lot of times the onus of his work is on Black people and their response to white supremacy and not as much on what is the role of the oppressor. Like, what is the responsibility of those who are in power, of those who are using violence? What's their role? What's their job? What are they required to do? And that's what I wanted to talk about, because we oftentimes look at Black people and say, well, you can be violent or you can be nonviolent. And it's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Who is asking white people to stop being violent? Who is asking white people to stop bombing churches where four little girls are killed, assassinating someone like Medgar Evers in their front yard? You know, nonviolence would not have saved those four little girls or Medgar Evers, or even the church in South Carolina where, you know, Dylann Roof walks into this Black church, is greeted by these Black parishioners and, you know, praying with them. And then he opens up fire on them. Nonviolence would have not saved their lives that day. And so I think we have to really push back on, like, who is supposed to be nonviolent? And how should we think about violence? And how can we push back on whiteness and violence and interrogate that just a little bit more? We don't sit enough with why white supremacy is so violent. We are more consumed with how Black people are going to respond to white supremacy than we are about how to dismantle it altogether.
And we will sit with that and some other of the great and provocative ideas you present in this book on the other side of a quick break. Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, her new book is called We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us. And welcome back to this archive edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, we're celebrating Black History Month by listening to a conversation with Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, the chair of the Africana Studies Department at Wellesley College and the host of a podcast called This Day in Esoteric Political History. Her first book is called Force and Freedom, Black Abolitionists and the Politics of Violence. It garnered several awards. Her latest book chronicles the many ways African Americans, particularly Black women, have opposed white supremacy through the ages. It's called We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we aren't able to take any calls or online comments today. Dr. Carter Jackson joined us on Zoom from Boston. So, Dr. Carter Jackson, I want to ask you to describe the cover of this book.
Happily.
There's a woman who looks to be, you know, dressed in not contemporary garb, and she's holding a rifle. Who is it? And tell us about that.
Well, the artist of this picture is a man by the name of Taha Clayton. He's a Brooklyn-based artist. And the picture is actually called Soldier of Love. It's huge. The original picture is probably 7 feet tall. And she's sort of surrounded by trees, a blue sky. There's a laundry line hanging in the back. She has on a white sort of 19th century cotton dress that starts at her neck with a collar and flows all the way down to her feet. And she has a long shotgun rifle in her hand. And my editor actually saw this painting first. And when he saw it, he was so arrested by it. He said, wow, this looks like Kelly's cover. And so he sent me an email and said, hey, I'm going to send you a picture of what I think would be a great cover for the book. Tell me what you think. So when I opened up the email, I was like, oh my God. I immediately loved it. Immediately. My husband, not so much, because he was like, another gun on the cover, because of Force and Freedom has just a pistol on the cover of my first book. But when I saw it, it just felt arresting. It felt powerful. It felt beautiful. It felt like I knew this woman, like she was, you know, a relative, an auntie. I felt like we all sort of know Black women in our lives that are very much no nonsense. But the gun is pointed down. It's not pointed at someone. And she's looking out with this sort of protective stance. Like, you know, if you run up on me, there's trouble. But if you don't run up on me, we're good. Like, and I think in a lot of ways that has sort of exemplified how Black people are and how they've had to navigate certain spaces in which most people do not want to engage in violence. They don't want trouble. But if it comes up on them, they have to be prepared to think about how they're going to respond. And so I absolutely love the picture. It's so stunning to me.
And the argument is stunning, too, because what you're doing is dismissing the common binary between violence and nonviolence. In that, and you're expanding it, I guess. Yeah. You're saying that it's not just, you know, dare I say it, black or white. It's not, yeah. It's not left and right. So what is it? If it's not, I mean, violence,
it's all of
met
the
with
above.
Violence and, you know, or it's, met with nonviolence. I mean, I, yeah. How's that work? If it's not binary, what is it?
I think it is a sort of all of the above. I think that we have a lot of tools at our disposal to combat white supremacy. And that when we think of violence or nonviolence, even that it handcuffs us because, you know, we think, well, if you're not going to be nonviolent, then you have to be violent. And, you know, my advisor, Barbara Fields, told me in grad school, she said, all violence is forceful, but not all force is violence. You know, force can be a boycott. It can be a strike. Force can be your vote. Force can be quitting. Force can be, you know, cancel culture in some ways. There are a lot of tools that people have to sort of call out racism. And I think when we think of nonviolence, we think nonviolence is just a protest or a march or a hashtag. And it's so much more than that. You know, I tell a lot of stories of people that have used guns or not used guns or used their voice or used their bodies and used, you know, their art and even humor to dismantle like the power of whiteness. And I think that all of those tools are available to us. And so when we realize that we have so much more than just this or that, than just violence or nonviolence, it means that all of us can actually take part in dismantling white supremacy. That if you can, I use your poetry, absolutely you can use poetry. Can I use my art? Absolutely you can use the art. Can I create a school? Absolutely you can create a school. Can I use my vote? Of course. Like, there are so many different ways in which we can engage in progressive practices that bring about real systemic change, not just symbolic change, although symbols do matter, but thinking about the ways we can change the lives that we all live in for the better. That's something we can all take part in, white, black, people of color, all alike.
But aren't those things, the poetry, the freedom schools, the art, aren't those manifestations of nonviolent reactions and responses to the white violence that, as you so absolutely accurately you know, document, is mm-hmm. been long part of the white supremacist culture?
Yes. It can be. And I think it's important to understand how nonviolence in some ways can have limitations in the way that we understand it, society large or culturally. And I also think that in some ways, not only does nonviolence have limitations, but that nonviolence can even be weaponized against people who are trying to have much more effective strategies. Because if we think that nonviolence is just a march, let's say, then, and we march, and that march doesn't bring about sort of the purpose that it intended, then that is how we handicap people. We say, no, you can only march. You can only march, because we know that marches are not really effective, but we can't say that. So we will tout nonviolence and marches as the only appropriate stance because we know that it doesn't work. And I think we saw in 2020, especially, I mean, we had the largest protest in American history that we have ever had before. Places where there were no black people to places where there were all black people. People were protesting wholesale. And the entire summer was rife with protest and hashtags and, you know, displays of sort of public civil disobedience. And 6 months later, we had January 6th, in which you have white nationalists and supremacists and Trump supporters taking over the federal government, trying to take over the Capitol. And I'm just blown away by that. I'm blown away by the ineffectiveness of what those marches accomplished, the swift backlash and retrenchment that we saw 6 months later, and the lack of sort of accountability and comeuppance that we've seen happen to some of these people who engaged in January 6th. Now, some people are being prosecuted, but for the most part, you know, if that had been Black people, if that had been people of color, if that had even been, you know, largely poor people, we would not see the same outcome. And so I want to really get people to tease out these double standards, these dichotomies, the way that media and society shapes these ideas about what we think nonviolent is, and just expand it and maybe even explode it a little bit more.
Yeah, and I mean, even President Biden made the comment that had it been a Black mob storming the Capitol, it would have been handled differently. And I think almost everybody assumes that's the case. We don't know that specifically. There have been, you know, they've been 700-something prosecutions, 700 people sent to jail and more on the way. It's hard to exactly understand how it was, but certainly the assumption that it would have been handled differently had it been a Black mob is one that's reasonable to make. But I wonder, is it the ineffectiveness of nonviolence that is key here? I mean, if you think about Dr. King, I mean, he was nonviolent, and he got the Civil Rights Act, he got the Voting Rights Act, he got the Fair Housing Act. I mean, it's not as if he came up empty-handed.
Yes, but I think those, when you look at the Voting Rights Act, which has since been gutted and has to be renewed every several years, this was not permanent change. Even when you think about civil rights wholesale, there are certain laws de jure that have changed, but on the ground, we have not seen that kind of systemic change. One of the reasons why MLK is engaged in the Poor People's Campaign in 1968, right before he's assassinated, is because he realized that all of that civil rights legislation was not enough, that people were still without jobs, that people were still unemployed, that Black people were still being undereducated, and that Black people were still upset and angry. And he talks about, he gives a speech in 1966, he's in Chicago, he gets booed by Black people. And King himself is like, why are they booing me? And he's like, oh, I know why. Because for years, I've been preaching to them about this dream, and this dream has turned into a nightmare. And he talks about how we've gotten civil rights on the cheap, that it never cost the federal government anything, that it didn't require people to sort of change their ways. And so when I think about, you know, his six principles for nonviolence, a lot of it is teaching Black people and people of color how to respond to the violence of white supremacy. But it's not necessarily addressing, you know, what I call in a spiritual and secular sense, repentance. It's not addressing what is the responsibility of the oppressor, what is those who are in power, who wield all kinds of the ability to harm people. What is their impetus for change? What is going to get them to relinquish or to forfeit power? How do you get people to stop hoarding resources and access to resources? I don't think we have seen a proper model for that. I think we've only taught Black people how to respond in the face of the cops or in face of dogs, but we haven't taught the police how to respond when they see Black people, when they see Black children. And that to me has never sat very well with me. It feels very incomplete. So it doesn't mean that you throw out King like the baby with the bathwater. No, I think it means you have to add more tools to your belt to say nonviolence and maybe a little force, maybe a little protection, maybe a little flight, maybe a little joy, maybe a little rest. Those things, I think, matter too, equally matter just as much.
And I was fascinated to learn about the internal tensions on this question that you write about. You tell us about a guy named Robert F. Williams, who was the president of the Monroe, North Carolina branch of the NAACP. He drove Roy Wilkins nuts, who was the executive, the head of the national NAACP. And Williams said, if it's necessary to stop lynching with lynching, then we must be willing to resort to that method. We must meet violence with violence.
Yeah. Now, I don't always agree with that, but I will say this. Here's where Robert F. Williams is not wrong, that when Black people started to protect themselves and form these sort of protection societies when they got guns and when the Klan realized that their lives were just as much a threat as Black people's lives were. And when they realized that they might get shot at or not go home with their mothers, a lot of that violence stopped. Some of it stopped altogether. Some of it stopped much quicker than it would have in any other circumstance. And what I also think is incredible all throughout the 1960s in particular, is that you see Black people that have guns, rarely do they have to use them. Rarely have you heard any incidents in which a Black man is killing a white man, but just the presence of that defense, of that ability to be able to say, we will shoot back. We will protect our family, our friendships, our kin. That was enough to stop a lot of people. And so Daisy Bates, you know, she's the leader of the Little Rock Nine in Arkansas, and she's packing heat. You know, she has to have a gun on her wherever she goes because her house was firebombed. Her life was threatened. People shot into her home. They threw rocks into her home. There's one story where there is a white man who throws a rock into her home, and he's getting ready to throw like either another rock or a stick of dynamite. And she comes out with a gun and was like, yo, get off my property or else. And he runs away. But like those moments in which Black people are able to stop a greater violence from coming, I think in some sense, Robert F. Williams was right. I don't think that he was necessarily intent on lynching other white people, but he understood that when white people felt like their lives were threatened, when they engaged in these racist shenanigans, they stopped. And so having a forceful defense was effective in that case. And many other cases, I should say.
You're listening to an archive edition of Midday. It's part of our Black History Month celebration. I spoke with Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson about her latest book, We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Dr. Jackson is the chair of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. We'll hear more of our conversation after a quick break. Our show was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or online comments today. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us. Welcome back to this Black History Month encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, we're listening to a conversation I had last summer on Juneteenth with Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson. She's the chair of Africana Studies at Wellesley College in Massachusetts and the host of a podcast called This Day in Esoteric Political History. We spoke about her latest book, We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Dr. Carter Jackson takes her title in part from what she describes as a key refrain in Black feminist politics as well as Native politics. In her preface to this forceful history, Dr. Carter Jackson writes, quote, "This book pushes against and beyond the dominant civil rights narrative that conditions us to see Black people as worthy actors because of their commitment to nonviolence." Our conversation was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or online comments. So, Dr. Carter Jackson, you also have a chapter about revolution, and you talk about Haiti in particular, Toussaint Louverture, and the constitution that he instituted when he led his revolution there. And you talk about how it did a unique thing because he refers to the rights not to be conferred on men or citizens, but literally inhabitants. Why is that an important distinction, and how do you place Louverture's importance in history?
Oh, man, I'm so glad that you brought that up because that's so important. Like, when we think about the American Revolution, and I'm using this as a contrast, and we think about, you know, like all men are created equal and ideas of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. But the read on that is that this is really just applying to white men and really white men with property. That's really important as well. That it's not sort of a God-given sort of idea. But when we think about, and when we think about the fact that a lot of the founding fathers were slaveholders, I think that hypocrisy sort of runs rife all throughout that moment. But when we think about the Haitian Revolution, The Haitian Revolution understood that you could not have a revolution unless it abolished the institution of slavery. That the idea that all people, inhabitants, men, women, children, people, human beings, were able to sort of announce their humanity without any sort of impediment, to be able to say, no, this is not something I confer to you, I give to you. This is something that you just are. It is because you are. I think that is so profound. And when we think about the age of revolutions, you know, it's the American Revolution, it's the French Revolution, it's the Haitian Revolution. But I make the argument that it is really only the Haitian Revolution that's an actual revolution. Because when we think about revolutions, revolutions are meant to replace broken systems or oppressive systems with better systems, with just systems. We don't get that in the United States. When you think about the American Revolution, life is not better for Native Americans. Life is certainly not better for enslaved people. It's certainly not better for women. That there's no revolutionary change other than the fact that you have a distant local leader now, a distant leader replaced with the local leader. But in the Haitian Revolution, abolishing slavery is at the forefront. Establishing citizenship for all is at the forefront. And they can't really make sense of a revolution that doesn't include that. I think about how Simon Bolivar comes to the Haitian president for assistance when he's trying to fight his own, you know, revolution in South America. And it's the Haitian president that says, listen, we will help you. We will give you all that you need on the one condition that you abolish slavery for all of South America. We cannot help you unless your revolution is really going to be revolutionary. And that to me has just always gripped me about how Haitians have thought about freedom for all and what liberation looks like. What it should really look like.
And this, again, this tension of how to respond to white supremacy. It's an age old tension. You write about W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington, the political activist approach versus the accommodationist approach. You know, Dr. King's beloved community, Malcolm X's by any means necessary. Is that argument still going today? I mean, are there new spins on that argument today?
Yeah.
Post Black Lives Matter, post,
yes,
you know, George Floyd and 2020 and the protests that, as you mentioned, you know, happened all around this country and around the world.
Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I think I said earlier, you know, I hate binaries and dichotomies. And I think when we think about like people like W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker T. Washington or MLK and Malcolm X, there's a group of people we're not talking about, which is Black women. We never grapple with Black women thinkers or leaders. And so I don't think you can address these issues until you deal with Black women, which is why I center Black women all throughout the book, because, you know, the Combahee River Collective talks about this idea that until you address like Black women's humanity, that no other oppressive system can fully be dismantled until you have dealt with the harms and the violence of Black women. That Black women stand at sort of the forefront of racial violence and sexual violence. And until you deal with that, nothing else matters. And so I think that there's something about being able to say, no, let's put to the side the W.E.B. Du Bois and the Booker T's and the MLKs and the Malcolm X's. Let's look at the Harriet Tubmans. Let's look at the Ida B. Wells. Let's look at the, you know, Daisy Bates and all these other Black women that have given us a much more expansive way of looking at liberation and freedom and what it takes to get there and how it can work for all. And so I try to do that throughout every single chapter in my book, is to say like, no, you're not going to get your typical Black leader versus this Black leader kind of contention, that you're really going to get people that you might know and people that you've never heard of before. And that to me is always enriching, because I tell my students in my class, you know, regardless of whatever class it is that I'm teaching, I say, I'm going to tell you about people that you know. I'm going to tell you something you don't know about the people you think you know. And then I'm going to do something even greater. I'm going to tell you about people you've never heard of before. And I think it's really powerful to learn something new. And then it's also important to be reminded of what you think you know and have a different spin or angle on it.
If you've just joined us, it's an encore edition of Midday today. In celebration of Black History Month, we're listening to a conversation I had last summer on Juneteenth with the historian and author Kelly Carter Jackson. Dr. Carter Jackson is the chair of the Africana Studies Department at Wellesley College and the host of a podcast called This Day in Esoteric Political History. We're talking about her latest book, which I found provocative and imaginative. It's called We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. Our show was pre-recorded, so we can't take any calls or emails today. Here's more of my conversation with Kelly Carter Jackson. When you talk about black women and you talk about some of the folks that many people haven't heard of, my ignorance of black history is boundless, but one of the things I had not known about before reading your book is something called the Christiana Resistance. This is in Pennsylvania 10, 15 years before the Civil War in 1851. There are four fugitive slaves whom you name, Noah Bewley, Nelson Ford, George Ford, and Joshua Hammond. They show up looking for safe haven, and a large group of black women went to help protect them. And this is in the chapter about protection as one of the ways of black resistance.
This is one of my favorite stories to tell. I tell this story in We Refuse, and there's parts of it in Force and Freedom, but it just represents how the black community rallied together, not just for their family members or their friends, but any fugitive that came to their doorstep, they were willing to help them. And so William and Eliza Parker are sort of station masters on the Underground Railroad, and they have a reputation for housing fugitive slaves and helping them either, you know, stay in Pennsylvania or to go further north up to Canada, where a lot of enslaved people left because it was sort of the only safe haven, especially after the fugitive slave law. You were not safe unless you were outside of the United States. And so, or in a really protected abolitionist stronghold. And so when these four men come to their house, you know, Eliza sounds the alarm. She starts blowing on this horn to alarm the Black Protection, the Lancaster Black Protection Society. And within moments, you know, the slave catcher, Edward Gorsuch, his son, his nephew, U.S. Marshals, they're surrounded by 80 men and women, some with rifles and pistols, some with like just farm equipment and pitchforks, ready to protect these four men. And in the end, there is a physical altercation in which Edward Gorsuch, the slaveholder, lies on the ground and he's dying. He's been beaten up badly by his enslaved property. And William Parker writes about this in his narrative. He says something that just struck me. He said, Edward Gorsuch lay on the ground dying, and the women put it into him. The women put it into him. And I was just like, what? And it showed me that, you know, violence is not gendered, that Black women also sought to defend themselves in many different ways. And in some instances, I feel like Black women had even more of a reason to use force against slaveholders because they understood how they were violated from their wombs to tomb. You know, they faced the loss of their children, the separation of from their children at the auction block. And so for Black women to take up force and violence in this way was just so compelling to me. And, you know, after this affair is over, all of the four fugitive slaves, they get to Canada. They lived out the rest of their days in freedom. William and Eliza Parker also make it to Canada as well. And it's interesting, too, because I found out later that Edward Gorsuch's son was good friends with John Wilkes Booth. And at the end of this altercation, no one is held accountable. There's basically a mistrial for the death of Edward Gorsuch. And John Wilkes Booth says, like, I cannot believe that a slave catcher or I cannot believe that a slaveholder was killed and that no one was held accountable. And he says it really sort of fuels his belief that, you know, he eventually kills Abraham Lincoln. But this idea of him killing or assassinating Abraham Lincoln comes much earlier than I think people realize.
Yeah, and of course, the lack of accountability for deaths when it comes to lynching comes to, you know, the horrible perpetration of violence against black people. You know, these became entertainments. They became, you know, things that people were, you know, Barnum and Bailey selling, you know, the spectacles. So, yes. so the egregiousness is certainly, you know, well documented, but, but also the appalling nature of the violence is something that, for example, Dr. King used to great advantage. I mean, the videotape, the television images of Bull Connor and the violence on the Edmund Pettus Bridge were a big factor in turning white America against the Southern race. It's the violence in Gaza has turned people against Israel. The violence in Ukraine has turned people against Russia. I mean, violence, you know, what is the role of speaking to people's just general moral character?
That's a very good question, because it's something that I think about a lot. I think about when we think about atrocities that are happening all over the world, how much that motivates us and activates us to want to speak up and speak out against those crimes. But I also want to think about the fact that when we think about these violent, horrific crimes, if you don't believe that Black people are human beings, just like the rest of us, like if you don't believe they're ordinary human beings, then you can't compel someone's consciousness. Then you can't motivate them to say, oh, that's so sad, too bad. You can't motivate them to want to speak out. You know, as much as for everything that's happening in Gaza and in Ukraine, we haven't spoken up enough about what's happening in Haiti and in the Congo and in Sudan. And I tell a story in the introduction about South Africa and apartheid. And Bishop Desmond Tutu says, you know, in America, they could use sort of like Christian morality to employ, to implore Northerners to sort of break their hearts with these images of children and fire hoses and dogs. But he says in South Africa, you know, that wasn't the case, because white people believed that apartheid was divine. They believed that it was built into their own Christian faith. And so how do you compel someone moralistically or ethically when they do not believe that you are a human being and they do not believe that you are worthy of such protections? And I think that that's something that we ought to grapple with more, because that empathy or lack thereof is something that makes it very easy to dismiss violence in one place and maybe embrace it in another.
We have less than a minute left, but you have a postscript to this book, which I found fascinating. You talk about lifeguards and when they are instructed. There are times when you are, if you're training to be a lifeguard, you're told to let people drown if they are fighting back too abruptly and acutely, and then you can revive them. How do we let racism drown?
That's a good question. I've got less than a minute. That is something that I have thought about a lot, because I think we have seen these sort of panics and these boogeymans and this fear mongering about DEI and about book banning. And people have sort of lost their minds, rationally speaking, about how we think about race and racism. And I don't have a perfect answer for how you combat that, but I do know you cannot engage the panic person when they're in the water, that their panic and fear can put your own risk at life. And so for some of these things that I see happening across the country, I see a lot of Black people just waiting for that moment when the person is tired and weary and just on the brink. And, you know, Black people have always been the lifeguards in this country, but have always sort of called out the strong tides, always had to rescue people from their elections. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in this election too, how Black people choose to intervene or not.
Dr. Kelly Carter Jackson, we spoke last summer on Juneteenth, several months before the 2024 election and before Vice President Kamala Harris became the Democratic nominee. Dr. Carter Jackson is an associate professor and chair of Africana Studies at Wellesley College. We spoke about her latest book, We Refuse, A Forceful History of Black Resistance. That's it for us today on this encore edition of Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.